following is a recording of Dr. Josh Michaud presenting Global Health on January 11, 2019. The speaker is introduced by Joan Lemoine.
Good morning. Those of you who participated in the 2018 Great Decisions discussion program will be familiar with our speaker today. He authored the Global Health Issues for the 2018 briefing book. And if you didn't pick up your 2019 briefing book, it was in the gathering space this morning. His writing reviewed global health's golden age, laying the platform to report on unfinished business and new challenges, including epidemics, pandemics, and global health security, the quality and availability of healthcare as highly unequal globally, the innovation gap and access to medicines, the role of governance, the private sector, and philanthropy in coordinated efforts to meet needs. He particularly got my attention as he noted, a pandemic could kill as many people as a devastating war, yet the resources committed to pandemic prevention and response are a fraction of the resources we commit to security. There are also very few risks that have greater potential for catastrophic economic impact, but the measures we are taking to avoid another financial crisis are of an entirely different magnitude. This is the neglected dimension of global security. Dr. Michaud is Associate Director for Global Health Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation, where he helps guide and oversee the foundation's research and analysis in the area of global health. He's an authority on a wide range of global health policy issues, including financing, the role of U.S. agencies in global health diplomacy, and health security and emerging diseases. He's a professional lecturer at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, where he's taught courses on global health policy, health, and development. Prior to Kaiser, he worked as an epidemiologist with U.S. Department of Defense and the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And for our students in the balcony, who I want to reinforce, there's no direct route from your undergraduate degree to your career. And the importance of a liberal arts education. He holds a doctorate in international health policy from Johns Hopkins, an MA in applied economics from Johns Hopkins, and an MHS in epidemiology from Johns Hopkins. And his bachelor's degree, as I recall, was political science and biology. So again, there's no direct route. So study what you want to study. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Michaud to speak about global health challenges.
Thank you. I assume this microphone is working. You can all hear me. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Joan, and for that kind introduction and welcome. And thank you all for coming today. This is fantastic to see such interest in this topic of global health. I'll hold off on talking about myself and get right into the subject matter at hand. I know there's probably a lot of questions. This is a topic which brings up a lot of passionate interest, and I do hope to get to your questions and start a conversation about this topic as well. So, as you know, I'm here to talk about global health, and that phrase might mean many different things to you out there. What I want to impress on you is that global health right now, as it's used in the field where I operate, it's a thriving field of study and practice, and I hope to give you a glimpse of what we mean when we talk about global health in this field of study and practice. And I hope that you will, by the end of this talk, understand or come to share my belief that global health is very consequential and can be viewed as one of the most, if not the most, fundamental important issues of our time, or really any time. So what might we mean by global health? We can think of that as a snapshot of the state of health of people across the world. We try to measure and understand how healthy people are, here in the United States, in other countries, at local levels, at country levels, regional levels, and at the global level. We try to understand what are the challenges to health. What are the things that are causing people to get sick, and what are the things that are causing them to suffer from disability, not only what kills them. We want to know how long people live. An important indicator, which I'll come back to in this talk again and again, is life expectancy, which is a crude measure, but the best measure that we have to compare health at its most basic level across countries. But not only that, we want to know about the quality of life. So global health is about achieving a better quality, not just a longer life. You want to make sure that the years that you spend longer in your life are spent in health and not in disability. And then finally, what are we doing as a country, as a community, as individuals to ensure that people here and everywhere are living their longest, healthiest lives possible? That's what global health is about. So it's hard to argue with the notion that saving lives and keeping the world free of preventable disability and illness is an important topic. But you might wonder, and this is a group that's focused on international issues, what does health have to do with foreign policy? And it might be the first time that health has come up as a discussion topic here in this group. So another thing that I hope you take away from this talk is that this idea that health, in fact, does fit as a pressing foreign policy issue. It deserves our time and attention and our resources, not only from us as individuals, but as a government, to improve global health around the world. So I'll start off by saying that I'd like to have you walk away with what seem like two seemingly contradictory takeaways from this talk. Explain why last year was the best year for people's health around the world in human history, and to provide reasons why we might be worried about where we are going in the future in terms of our global health. So let me go back to the past before we get to the present. One thing which I would like to stress is that throughout human history, the predominant cause of death and ill health has been infectious diseases. Bacteria, viruses, parasites, and other microbes cause much of the misery around the world for human existence. So the history of human health has been the history of struggles against epidemics. As historian William McNeill wrote in his book, Plagues and Peoples, infectious diseases have always been a fundamental parameter and determinant of human history. Even though they're not often framed as such, they have been. And I'll give you a couple of examples. You've heard of the Black Death, which was the plague epidemic which swept through Europe in the 14th century. This is a disease caused by a bacteria carried by rodents and transferred to humans via the bite of an infected flea. The toll of the Black Death, which began about 1320 and lasted for about a decade or more, depending on the location, was nothing short of horrifying. It was a horrifying event. After the event, the population in Europe was one-third that of it 100 years before. The population in Europe did not recover from that decline in population for another 200 years. So you can imagine the kinds of social implications that this toll had in those countries. The feudal system was changed forever, and it's marked the beginning of the end of the era of kings and peasants, because labor was short, and the peasants had more power to determine their labor conditions. The most powerful institution at the time was the Catholic Church, and the church itself lost almost half of its priests and bishops, which led to Pope Clement VI selling the ability to be a priest allowing priests to sell indulgences to congregations. And that discontent which flowed from that laid the groundwork for the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s. From this time comes one of the key public health terms that I'm sure you've all heard that we still use, and that's quarantine, which derives from the Italian for 40 days, which is the amount of times that ships were placed in isolation at port in order to prevent the transmission of disease, particularly plague. And it's interesting that this practice came into being because at that time there was no understanding about what was actually causing disease, but they knew it worked. Germ theory, or the germ theory of disease, which linked certain bacteria and viruses to illnesses, didn't emerge until 400 years after. The other example that I'd like to talk about is the Columbian Exchange, which is the term for the arrival of the Europeans in the Americas. The meeting of the two worlds that occurred after 1492 with the arrival of the Spanish conquistadors in particular to the Americas, in Mexico and Peru in particular. In that exchange, when the Spanish arrived, the old world diseases that they carried were let loose on the population of Amerindians that had never been exposed to these diseases before. We're talking about plague, yellow fever, cholera, malaria, smallpox, typhoid, typhus, and a number of other diseases. These hadn't been seen in the Americas until the arrival of the Spanish. In the wake of their arrival, because of these diseases, 3/4 of the native population of the Americas died. And that is the reason why we can point to the fact that a force led by Pizarro in what is now Peru, with 168 Spanish conquistadors, was able to lay low a force of 80,000 Inca warriors. You can imagine what the dynamic might have been had the disease flow been the opposite direction, and the implications for the subsequent colonial period, which has been such an important force in history. So, quoting another historian, Hans Zinsser, who says, "Swords and lances, arrows, machine guns, explosives have had less power over the fates of nations than the typhus louse, the plague flea, the yellow fever mosquito. Civilizations have retreated from malaria, and armies have crumbled into rabbles under the onslaught of cholera or dysentery." It's these infectious diseases which kept human lives nasty, Brutus, and short, as it were. And when you think about these diseases, they have a disproportionate toll on children. Many children throughout history died before their first birthday. And that's where we get this low life expectancy numbers. If about 1/4 or 1/5 of children are dying before their first or fifth birthday, life expectancy in that location is very, very low. Even in the U.S. 100 years ago, we were living in a completely different time. 100 years ago in the United States, 1 in 5 children died before their first birthday. Life expectancy was 48 years, which is lower than many of the poorest countries in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia today. It's because we didn't have the tools necessary to combat infectious diseases until the 1800s. That's when things began to turn around. Scientists and doctors began to figure out what it was that was making us sick and killing us as children. That's when this germ theory of disease emerged. And it led to some incredible success stories. The first for which we have evidence is the incredible life expectancy increase that we saw in England and Wales, which is the first place where this was tracked systematically. We had programs of sanitation, which prevented the diseases which were killing many children. We had access to clean water instituted. We had better nutrition for children, all of which led to an incredible rise in life expectancy tracked in England and Wales in the mid to late 1800s. There were also broad social programs, which not directly health, also contributed to better health. These included new labor laws. Instead of having child laborers, which was detrimental to health, there were more controls on child labor instituted. There were controls on pollution and contamination of air and water sources, all of which added up to a lot more children living and life expectancy increasing. Another story I'd like to talk about is the Panama Canal. And what some of you may know is that the United States, which of course held control of the canal for about 100 years, wasn't the first power to try and build the canal. It was actually the French. In the late 1800s, the French started their effort to build the canal connecting the Atlantic and the Pacific, but failed miserably for a number of reasons. Part of it was their corruption, part of it was mismanagement, but a lot of it had to do with the fact that they had no way to control the tropical infectious diseases which existed in the canal zone and which were killing workers by the hundreds. We're talking about yellow fever, malaria in particular. In fact, the French didn't try to institute any kind of protective measures that were effective. They did, in fact, just the opposite. Because there was a belief that disease was transmitted by bad air, they would throw open the windows and put people in places where there was fresh air coming in, but that also brought in the mosquitoes which were transmitting the disease. So the French abandoned the project, and of course the U.S. took over, and they brought in U.S. Army physicians who had successfully controlled mosquito populations in places like Cuba with a new approach, making that link between mosquito and disease. And they instituted what can be described as a military-style campaign to eradicate the canal zone of malaria mosquitoes. And they were incredibly successful. They would institute screens and protective clothing for the workers. They had viscous oil put on top of all of the lagoons and pools which were of stagnant water in order to kill the mosquito larvae. They would fumigate areas where there were people. And while not exactly custodians of the environment by doing this, they did successfully kill the mosquitoes, and death rates from yellow fever and malaria plummeted in the canal zone, allowing the work to continue, and as we know, the U.S. to maintain this strategic asset for the following 100 years. And then one other story to share is that of China. And as we know, China has undergone an incredible economic boom since the 1970s, where over 500 million people have been lifted out of abject poverty in that country over 40 years. That was predated by a transformation in their healthcare system, which came 20 years prior to that. In the late 1940s, the Chinese government instituted a broad campaign focusing especially on the rural poor to bring healthcare and the interventions which were needed to prevent disease to the rural poor. There was a system of trained medical professionals, not exactly doctors, but trained enough to provide the basic medical care needed at the rural level, eventually called the barefoot doctors. They would provide vaccines, they would care for mothers who were pregnant, they would oversee births, they would provide medications where they were available. And because of that effort, the life expectancy in China, which was around 44 years in the 1940s, grew to 65 in the mid-1970s, an amazing increase. And why? Because those diseases which were killing children, those infectious diseases, were now being reduced at a great scale. So we know, and we've known for a long time, how to reduce mortality in children from these infectious diseases. And they've been applied more broadly now from the lessons that we've gleaned in public health and medicine. And that's what global health is about. No other development in the last 150 years, I would say, not world wars, not the internet, not democracy, has shaped the lives of people around the world more than the decline in infectious diseases. This is the modern history of global health. How do we get these miracle approaches and treatments to the people who need them most now? Think about one single piece of health technology, the smallpox vaccine. This vaccine, which only started to be ramped up in its use in the mid-1900s, this single vaccine has saved more lives than if we had eliminated all deaths from war, famine, and genocide in the 20th century combined. And that's just that one vaccine. We have vaccines against other killers, measles, and mumps, and rubella, and polio, tetanus. Not to mention all of the other improvements, nutrition and water and sanitation. Put all those together and you have a truly dramatic transformation in the health landscape at a global level that we've not seen before. We have new tools, of course, antibiotics, which only were developed after the post-World War II period. We have something called oral rehydration therapy, which is a mixture of salt, sugar, and water that we can provide to children suffering from diarrhea, which prevents death from dehydration. We have better nutrition, an understanding of what it means to have better nutrition. All of these have fed into the success that we've seen. And in this country, we've benefited from all of these. But there's a gap that has developed between the developed world and the developing world when it comes to health. In 1950, in more than 100 countries, there were still more than 1 in 5 children dying before their 5th birthday. The life expectancy for a baby born in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia at that time was 42 years. So to bring these new tools and approaches to the global level and to narrow that gap between the developed and the developing world, there was a number of institutions and mechanisms that have been created. First, I'd point to the creation of the World Health Organization, which was the first specialized agency of the UN system, created in 1948 in order to really to push forward this control of infectious disease agenda at the global level. We had UNICEF, which is, of course, the United Nations Children Agency, which in the late 1970s and early 1980s began to push for child survival. In fact, Jim Grant, an American who led UNICEF at that time, created what came to be called the Child Survival Revolution, based upon a simple set of interventions: breastfeeding, oral rehydration therapy, growth monitoring, and a core set of immunizations to prevent childhood deaths. And from 1980 to the most recent year we have data, 2015, the coverage rate for vaccinations across the world grew from about 15% of children covered by vaccinations to over 70% of children covered by vaccinations. It's an incredible, incredible effort put on by the international institutions, countries themselves, and communities to bring this life-saving technology where it's needed. The other important trend which I'd like to talk about is the emergence of a disease which transformed the global health landscape in 1980, and that is HIV/AIDS. At the start of the 80s, there was a feeling that because we had these fantastic approaches to reducing infectious diseases, that they would become a thing of the past, that we wouldn't have to worry about infectious diseases anymore. HIV/AIDS proved that to be wrong. What grew from a very small epidemic in certain risk groups has now become a truly global pandemic. So over 20 million people have died from HIV/AIDS, and somewhere around 30 million people continue to live with the HIV virus, and more people are infected every year. This created, for the first time, a link between health and foreign policy, health and national security. For the first time, the US government and others began to think about health as truly a national security problem because of HIV/AIDS. There was the first ever United Nations resolution around a health topic, which was created in 1999 through the efforts of Richard Holbrooke. There was the national security approach promoted by the Clinton administration and then the Bush administration to combat HIV/AIDS as a national security problem, with a thought that if this disease was allowed to spread more, there would be crumbling societies, there would be destabilization, there would be terrible social effects across the continent of Africa, and not to mention the supposed next wave of countries which would be affected, including China and India. All of this, this rise in HIV/AIDS, this continued issues of dealing with the old scourges of TB, of tuberculosis, malaria, childhood diseases, led to what was a transformation in the international approach to global health, what has come to be called the golden age for global health. There was the creation of an institution called the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations to carry forward the vaccine mission. There was the creation of an institution that was, and the idea of Kofi Annan, the former UN Secretary General, called the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. A new financing mechanism created in 2002, which has provided tens of billions of dollars to fight those three scourges of HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. The creation of what has become the cornerstone of the United States approach to global health, and that is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, which is a program created by George Bush in 2003. And that program provides funding to countries, mainly in sub-Saharan Africa, for prevention and treatment programs to combat the HIV/AIDS virus, to the tune of about $5 to $6 billion every year now. And because of these programs, and PEPFAR in particular, thousands, hundreds of millions of lives actually have been saved. And the health of societies has been transformed. I don't think it's overstatement to say that. Another institution which came up in the late 1990s was the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has become a critical component of the global health landscape and provides on the order of $2 to $3 billion a year to support health programs in developing countries, because Bill Gates, at the time the richest man in the world, took a look at the evidence and said, where can my money do the most good? And he determined that the most good that he could do was through global health programs, in particular supporting vaccines and immunizations and increases in technology. So countries and multilateral institutions came together during this golden age and worked together to achieve these goals, and the progress has been nothing short of spectacular. We've seen child mortality in the poorest countries today decline by more than half since 1990. At that time, 1990, 12 million children a year were dying of mostly preventable causes. We now have less than 6 million children dying of those causes every year, despite a growing global population. And for the first time in history, only a few years ago, the first time in human history, the first time ever that infectious diseases were not the leading cause of death and illness worldwide. That already has occurred. We've made the transition. But 12 million children dying to 6 million children dying is a great progress, but 6 million children dying is still a tragedy. There remains a lot more to be done in addressing health care in poor countries and bringing that inequality gap between, shortening that gap between those who have and those who have not. Not to mention, we have a number of new and emerging challenges when it comes to health. When children survive their childhood and grow on to be adults, it's only logical that they begin to face other types of illnesses and disease threats. So what we've seen with the child survivor revolution is the increase in chronic, so-called chronic diseases, non-communicable diseases, as they're termed in global health. So we're talking here about cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and other health challenges. We've seen dramatic increases in the number of people suffering from these in the developing world, disproportionate to the burden that we've seen in developed countries. And this represents a truly important task for global health for our time, addressing the rise in these non-communicable diseases in countries which don't have the resources to pay for them. Because when it comes to global health assistance, almost all of it is focused on these old scourges and infectious diseases. None of it focused on cancer, diabetes, heart disease, which are going to be the killers of the future. Another challenge is this idea of emerging infectious diseases or pandemics. You may know that 100 years ago, here in this country and around the world, we were dealing with the consequences of what was the most deadly infectious disease event ever recorded, and that was the 1918 influenza pandemic. Somewhere on the order of 50 million people died in the space of a year. HIV/AIDS has killed 20 million in 30 years. You can imagine the impact that that had at the time, although it's not much talked about. And one of the most pressing concerns for global health practitioners, and me in particular, is worrying about what will be the next pandemic. And influenza is always a threat, but there are others out there as well. You may remember an outbreak of a disease called SARS, Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, which emerged from China in 2002 and 2003. You might remember there was an Ebola outbreak a few years ago, which emerged in West Africa, eventually killing 11,000 people, including some people in the United States when it was imported and transmitted here. There are other diseases, threats as well. There's Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. There are a number of potential threats which we can't even know about yet because they will come to surprise us, as HIV/AIDS did in the 1980s. So this is something that the global community needs to come together around and needs to prioritize, and so far has not done so to the degree to which it is commensurate to its threat, which references the quote that Joan said at the beginning. That comes from the National Academy of Medicine's report, trying to make this argument that protecting the world from pandemics is a preeminent global security priority and a U.S. national security priority. Related to that is the increase in resistance to common antibiotics. We've seen that we have cases of virtually untreatable disease, including tuberculosis, gonorrhea, which is a foreboding thought that sometime in the future, unless we find new ways to address infectious diseases, common infectious diseases that you might get after surgery or after even a cut, won't be able to be treated with the common tools that we have now, and we might return to a pre-antibiotic age. Another thing that I'd like to bring up is a troubling trend is, in keeping with broader social trends, is this mistrust of science, of health institutions, of practitioners and experts. I think it's most clearly demonstrated by the rise in people refusing to accept vaccines for their children, and the spurious links being made between vaccinations and conditions such as autism, which has had real-world effects and has killed children around the world. In this country, we've remained very supportive of vaccines, although there are pockets of communities where we've seen this denialism increase. It's a very big problem growing in Europe and Asia right now, and particularly in Japan, where we see clusters of once diseases that were never seen before in a long time. Clusters of measles cases that have led children die needlessly. So monitoring that, countering that, making sure that the public has the understanding of why these vaccines are important is something that we need to push for going forward. And another challenge I'd bring up is that of climate change. And despite the negotiations and debates that are ongoing about it, there's no question that the climate is changing and that they have that changing climate has important implications for health, because a changing climate where we have more extreme weather, we have hotter regions, we have wetter regions, impacts people's health in many different ways, in terms of the nutrition that they get, in terms of the infectious diseases that are spread, in terms of the direct impacts on their health because of hurricanes, and floods, and other events. And those will only grow in the next 100 years. And in the negotiations that are ongoing, often health is not considered as an important component of it, although it should be. So it's a kind of a bleak picture after a good news story. But what do we do now? And there are some constructs out there that we can point to which point us in a positive direction. The UN has a system of goals that have set up with collaboration with countries called the Sustainable Development Goals. And within that are a set of goals around health, to provide health care to all at all stages of life. And to address that, or to achieve that vision, there is a new push for something called universal health coverage, which means providing quality health care everywhere to everyone who needs it. Of course, achieving that is difficult, as we can point to in our own country. Achieving universal health coverage seems like an impossible task, right? So you can imagine in other countries which are much more poorly resourced, trying to achieve universal health coverage with quality health care is a daunting prospect. But that's the those are the goals that are on the table, and those are the kinds of ambitious objectives that we need to be shooting for. And that is the way that we are going to solve all of those various challenges that I laid out, as well as address the unfinished business of global health, of preventing children dying, mothers dying from eminently preventable causes. So, in closing, I'd like all of you to take into consideration health as an important international issue, to give health its due in discussions around international relations. It's a topic that affects all of us, but you can move beyond just what is happening here and think about how it affects the globe as well. So I'll leave it there, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you.